It is a simple but fearful fact that every generation includes those who have despised or even hated Jesus, who have despised or even hated his message. Now, I'm not talking about people who hate Christians. That is related but slightly different, because let's face it, some Christians or those who claim the name of Christ do hateful things. Now, I'm talking about those who hate Jesus and his message. In the 18th century, the French Enlightenment philosopher Voltaire said this: "Christianity is the most ridiculous, the most absurd, and the most bloody religion that has ever infected the world." Then, in the 19th century, Friedrich Nietzsche put it more starkly in his famous book, Antichrist. He said this: "I call Christianity the one great curse, the one enormous and innermost perversion, the one moral blemish of mankind. I regard Christianity as the most seductive lie that has yet existed." He said many things, but he at least had the candor to say this as well: "It is our preference that decides against Christianity, not argument." It is our preference. Now, I hope you'll agree that somewhere along the line, there's a bit of a disconnect. It simply doesn't fit with the Jesus we commonly think of. I mean, surely he was good, he was kind, loving, honest, generous, gentle, and many other things. And they're good things, aren't they? They're attractive things, surely. And what's more, he did many good things for people. He loved them to bits, as we will see tonight. So what is so off-putting about that? Well, we'll find both tonight. We'll find Jesus doing great good and people who hate him. And it's chilling to see them side by side. Now, to grasp something of what Mark is telling us with these stories, we need to do a bit of geography. We're up in the north of Israel, around the shores of Lake Galilee, and this was the world that Jesus had known well since childhood. He'd grown up here. And last week, in chapter 7, verse 24, and then in verse 31, we saw that Jesus was right up on the west coast, on the Mediterranean coast, near the ports of Tyre and Sidon. And then he traveled down round Lake Galilee, down into the region of the Decapolis, as it was called. And Decapolis, that's a Greek word. It literally means 10 cities. And that, the fact that it has a Greek name, indicates a lot by itself. These are all Gentile regions. Gentiles, non-Jewish people, lived all around these areas. And that is crucial. It's crucial because without understanding that, we won't understand why on earth Mark feels the need to include yet another crowd-feeding miracle. Because back in chapter 6, there was a big one, the feeding of the 5,000. But this is where chapter 8 opens. We find another one, another great feeding. And I call this the compassion of Jesus, food for the hungry. So in chapter 6, we have the feeding of the 5,000, and within just a few verses, we have something that looks alarmingly similar. And some commentators, some people have assumed that Mark is a complete idiot. They think that there can only have been one miracle like this, or one big event, and yet different eyewitnesses got the numbers wrong, and so two different stories went down the line. And that led Mark, as he was looking at all the different accounts and pieces of paper he had on his desk, to assume that therefore there were two incidents. Well, stupid old Mark. Well, that is frankly pathetic. And Mark knew exactly what he was up to. He is writing what we now know as the shortest of the four Gospels. Space means a lot. He is very careful with what he includes. And apart from anything else, look, if you accept that Jesus can feed one crowd, you must accept that he can feed 2 or 20. I wouldn't be at all surprised if Jesus did this several times. So Mark knows what he's doing. He's got these two incidents. I'm sure they were separate events. And there are some interesting differences in the way that he tells it. So look how Mark begins in verse 1 of chapter 8. During those days, another large crowd, he's quite aware, another large crowd gathered. Since they had nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples to them and said, I have compassion for these people. They've already been with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. If I send them home hungry, they'll collapse on the way because some of them have come a long distance. Now, back in chapter 6, Jesus was also stirred by the crowds. He had compassion on them because, as back in chapter 6, he says, he saw them like sheep without a shepherd. And what does he do in response? Well, chapter 6, he began to teach them many things. The feeding miracle in chapter 6, the feeding of the 5,000, that comes about as a result of the disciples prompting and saying, look, everyone's wilting here. Perhaps we should send them off. And he says, no, I'm going to feed them. But in our passage, you see, yet again, he has compassion on them. But this time, what does he do? He feeds them. Not so much this time with teaching, although he's been doing that, but with physical bread. His compassion is worked out in these two different but thoroughly complementary ways. And it's a crucial element in Jesus' ministry that too many Christians miss. His compassion worked its way out in both ways, spiritual care and provision through teaching, and practical care and provision through food. We should never make the mistake of playing one off against the other. But it's interesting that the disciples are the ones with short memories. That they have their own bread supplies in verses 4 and 5, but they seem to have forgotten what's happened just a few weeks before. And just as with the first time and the feeding of the 5,000, so now with the 4,000, it is breathtaking. It blows the mind. These are creation miracles. This is creating food out of thin air, if you like. It's simply spectacular. I don't know, if you've ever been to, I don't know, a big music festival or something like that, you'll know how mind-boggling the logistics can be for those sort of things. Rachel and I, a year and a half ago, went to the big Nelson Mandela 90th birthday concert in Hyde Park. And it was an incredible thing. And it must have been an incredible feat of planning. Thousands were there. And they all needed feeding, watering, marshalling, keeping in order. And there seemed to be as many people involved in managing it all as there were spectators. And the event, undoubtedly, was months in the planning. But not so this moment in Jesus' life. It's spontaneous, it's huge. And for Jesus to have kept this lot happy is quite something in itself. But of course, a mark of a generous host is that there's more than enough to eat, isn't it? And nobody is to lose out. Well, Jesus is no exception. In verse 8, look at that. The people ate and were satisfied. After 3 days of hunger, how wonderful it must have been to have the sense of feeling well fed and full. And it was free. And what's more, there's plenty left over. 7 basketsful. Now, it's no accident that this comes after last week's passage. You remember that strange conversation at the end of chapter 7 that Jesus had with that woman from Tyre? When he seems to be giving her, you know, the sort of the elbow and keeping her at arm's length with that really weird remark about foods being not fit for the dogs and all the rest of it. She sees the point. So back in 7:28, she says this, even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. Very strange. And we saw last week that that was a metaphor for the children representing God's people, Israel, and the dogs, those who they regarded as beyond the pale, the unclean, the Gentiles or non-Jews. But this remarkable woman had the faith to see that even the dogs get the scraps after the meal. And Jesus is thrilled to feed her. Well, in Mark 6, Jesus fed 5,000 or more in Jewish territory. He fed them first. But here in Mark 8, where is he?
Gentile territory. 4,000. And he feeds them too. What that wonderful woman spotted in Jesus is true. His compassion, you see, is not racially bound, but open to all. He truly is the Lord for all. And what's more, he's not stingy. He doesn't give crumbs or scraps. This is actually a full meal with tons left over. And at that, he leaves. In verse 10, he gets into the boat and crosses over to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. In other words, he's heading to the western side, to the Jewish side, to this town of Dalmanutha. Now, no one knows exactly where Dalmanutha was, but most scholars agree that it's likely to have been near Magdala, on the western shore of Galilee. So remember what he's been up to. He's been traveling through Gentile territory, from the Mediterranean ports in the northwest to the Decapolis in the southeast, teaching, healing, and now feeding. And he's been mixing with all sorts, and at the very least, that was incredibly provocative to religious conservatives. A reaction was inevitable. And the way Mark tells us the story, it's as if the Pharisees, you know, it's almost as if they're there on the dockside waiting for him. So we've seen his amazing compassion. What do we find that he has to contend with on his return? The blindness of the Pharisees, which I guess was a surprise to many then. Look at verse 11. The Pharisees came and began to question Jesus and to test him. They asked for a sign from heaven. That's quite ironic, don't you think? After what's just happened. Jesus had just said a cast of thousands. And what other signs do you need? Okay, to be fair, they'd not necessarily witnessed the 4,000 feeding miracle. They were on the wrong side of the lake, fair enough. But of course, the 5,000, well, that had happened just perhaps a few weeks before on their side. What more does Jesus need to do? Now, I just suppose, if you were being ultra generous to them, you might say that this was a reasonable request. Fair enough. It shows willing, perhaps. An atheist was once talking to a Christian friend and said, look, okay, if there's a God, may he prove himself now by striking me dead now. Nothing happened. Ha! You see, there's no God. His friend was fortunately very quick, said, far from it. You've only proved that he's gracious. Now, many people would love God just to show himself like that. They want him to show his power. They want him to prove that he exists. The thing is, that's not quite what the Pharisees are after. They knew God existed, all right? They didn't have a problem with that. And in fact, they also recognized that Jesus had great power. They'd seen that in spades already. They just want to know if that power came from heaven or hell. Well, in fact, if they'd been honest, they'd already decided that one. Back in Mark chapter 3, way back, some of the religious leaders from Jerusalem, including some Pharisees, they claimed that Jesus was an agent of Satan. They claim his power came from the depths of hell. And from a terrifyingly early stage in the story, they're wanting to kill him. In many ways, their minds had been made up. And in verse 11, it's clear, well, Mark tells us, doesn't he? They're out to test him, to catch him out, to trap him. So no wonder Jesus' response is emotional. Look at verse 12. The English doesn't quite get the right gist. I mean, sigh deeply sounds like he's just a bit tired. This is a deep groan, a combination of frustration, of exhaustion, and even anger. Ugh! Why does this generation ask for a miraculous sign? I tell you the truth, no sign will be given it. After everything he taught and done and said, what was the point of giving a sign? What more can Jesus do for somebody who's made up their mind already? But why are they so opposed, so antagonistic? Don't they get it? Don't they realize who he is? How can they be so blind? You see, they were the ones who really should have known all along that they were God's leaders of God's people. And when God gets his hands dirty and gets involved in his world, well, they should have been the first people to realize that. And most of their contemporaries would have expected them. They were looking, I guess, to the Pharisees and other Jewish leaders to give a lead, to let them know when God was active. You can't expect everybody to get it, but the leaders, well, they should see it. Then they can tell everybody else. The fact that they didn't get Jesus was no doubt a huge surprise to their generation, even if it isn't so much of a surprise to those of us who are familiar with the story. But what was no doubt so depressing for Jesus that led to this just profound groaning was that this generation had not learned anything from history. You remember that other reading we had from Jeremiah 5? The blindness, the deafness of the people. Jeremiah said then, the people of God have rebellious hearts and have turned aside and gone away from God. So what Jesus does next is tragically symbolic. Do you see how Mark tells it? Verse 13. Then he left them. Got back into the boat and crossed to the other side. And by the time we get to the bit after our passage, verse 22, we see that he's arrived in Bethsaida on the northeastern shore of Galilee. Again, back into Gentile territory. There's something rather powerful about that. It actually seems to be making a statement in and of itself. He's heading back over to the Gentile side. He'd had a better reception there. People recognize something of him. Like that remarkable woman last week. But on the journey, or perhaps after they've reached the shore, it's not exactly clear which, Jesus has to deal with blindness that's closer to home. Rather disturbing blindness, the blindness of the disciples, which I guess might come as a surprise to many of us. Now, I'm not sure, but I think verse 14 is meant to be quite funny in a rather sad way. Think of all that's happened. Then verse 14, the disciples have forgotten to bring bread except for one loaf they had with them in the boat. What a disaster! They've forgotten the bread and probably left the gas on as well. Who knows? Now, after two colossal feeding miracles, when Jesus produced a bumper harvest at the click of his fingers, the disciples now get quite stressed about lack of food. Now, there's something a bit ironic there, don't you think? Something's not quite clicked with them. But Jesus uses this as a teaching opportunity, as so often. So verse 15, he warns them, be careful. Watch out for the yeast of the Pharisees and that of Herod. They discussed this with one another and said, it's because we got no bread. I mean, the disconnect is so strong with the disciples that they don't even hear the point he's making. They're still fretting about the bread. It's as if they hadn't even heard him mention the yeast of the Pharisees, whatever that is. They're deaf to his warnings. Now, we'll come back to what that yeast is in a moment. But Jesus' frustration now turns to his friends. Now, if the Jews of the day might have expected more from the Pharisees, we ourselves might have expected more from the disciples. And he says to them, why are you talking about having no bread? Do you still not see or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes but fail to see and ears that fail to hear? I wonder if you heard Jesus' echoes of Jeremiah's complaint from all those years before. But how it's directed to his own team. How can they worry about finding bread after all that's happened? I mean, he can provide bread if they need. They're missing something pretty big. They're missing who Jesus is. Because who he is will help them to understand what he can do. In fact, they're blind and deaf to it. But Jesus goes on, don't you remember? When I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many basketfuls of pieces did you pick up? 12? Yes. And when I broke the 7 loaves for the 4,000, how many basketfuls did you pick up? 7? Okay. Blank faces. Do you still not understand? I mean, the point is, after the feeding of the 5,000 and the feeding of the 4,000, here's the point. There's something to understand. There's something to get. And they don't. I mean, the disciples clearly remember the statistics. They just didn't remember what it or understand what it meant. Now, perhaps the numbers themselves are significant. 12 and 7 certainly are important in the Bible. The numbers of completeness, perhaps even perfection. And that might well be right, though neither Jesus nor Mark actually gives us any help in the text with it. And I confess I'm slightly thrown by why Jesus would want to have the leftovers adding up to a perfect number. But at the very least, it points to his amazing, generous provision. But whatever the numbers mean by themselves, there is a bigger point at stake. Now let me give you a clue. Jesus has just performed two great feeding miracles. He's provided bread to two huge crowds in the desert. Does that ring any bells? Yes, they are creation miracles. The God of creation is at work, making things out of nothing. But they're also Exodus miracles, aren't they? The God who led the people of Israel out of Egypt and into the desert, and more significantly for us tonight, kept them alive in the desert, the harsh, inhospitable environment of the Sinai desert, providing for their every need, physical and spiritual, providing manna in the desert. Jesus is doing what Yahweh, the God of Israel, what Yahweh alone has done in the past. He is feeding them with bread from heaven. You getting it yet? Because the disciples weren't. They were blind and deaf. In fact, and this is the most unsettling thing about this, they seem as unaware as the Pharisees were. But with one crucial difference. There was one key difference, and that's to do with yeast. Now, what is yeast? Well, yeast is, I looked this up, I didn't know this anyway, but I looked this up. Yeast is a powerful fungus with very strange properties. It can cause liquids to ferment into alcohol, but more significantly, put it into dough and place the dough in an oven, and it'll produce air bubbles that make the bread rise. A little bit goes a very long way. And that's the point of Jesus' metaphor. It's powerful stuff. And then when it's applied to the Pharisees and to their partners in crime, those working with King Herod, it was also very dangerous stuff. Because it's all about a closed mind, if not a hostile mind. It's all about attitude. You see, the Pharisees was a hardness of heart that refused to accept God when he spoke. I'm not having any of that, is the sort of mindset. You see, they'd already decided to kill Jesus way back into Mark chapter 3. They decided to kill him. So they come here in Mark 8, not so much to inquire, but to test. They sought signs not to convince them, but to trap him, perhaps with the semblance of honest searching. Their minds were made up. But the thing is, you see, that is an infectious attitude. It spreads. And it can leave people permanently spiritually blind. And that's the danger with Jesus' disciples. After what has just happened, and what they still don't get, Jesus is very concerned for them. He warns them. You see, the danger is not so much the fact that they are blind. Well, of course they are. In a sense, one of the lessons that we find as Mark's gospel unfolds is that everybody's blind. And what Jesus claims is so extraordinary, even preposterous. that God would come down to our level, that God, the Creator, would get his feet muddy in the banks of the Jordan River? God? Of course it's hard to see that, to come to terms with it. Of course it is. It actually needs a divine miracle of healing for somebody able to see and hear. Which, as we saw last week, is something Jesus can do. And as we will see next week in the rest of Mark 8. Now you see, the issue is not so much blindness or deafness. Everybody's blind. The issue is what we do with it. Do we come to the one who can give us sight? Now we'll see that he can do that in next week's passage. Or do we harden our hearts to Jesus and say, no way? I'll never forget a lunch I had with a friend earlier this year. And we met up for lunch over in Canary Wharf, where he works, two or three times. And he's someone who is fully immersed in the so-called New Atheism. He's a disciple of Richard Dawkins and many others, and just absolutely convinced that we live in a closed universe, a universe where there is no God, and it's just what you see is what you get. And this was the third time we met for lunch, and neither of us was getting very far. We weren't making any progress with either. And there was a complete impasse between us. In the end, I just asked him to consider whether he would ever pray. A prayer, something like this. I don't know, God, just in case you're there, if you're there, I don't get you yet, but please help me to. What's there to lose? I suppose it's quite a dangerous prayer in one sense, because God might just answer it. But what's there to lose? And this friend of mine said, no, I'm not going to do that. I'd never do that. And there we had to leave it. Now, who knows what his reasons are? I don't fully understand them. Who knows why many people reject Jesus? Who knows exactly why Nietzsche's preference decided against Jesus? But I think for the Pharisees, it's probably clear. Jesus was a threat to their power, their prestige, their authority. And even if he had been sent by God, well, as far as they were concerned, he could not be allowed to interfere with their position. And so they were determined to silence him. They were determined to kill him. Now that's just what Jeremiah called stubborn and rebellious hearts. That is the yeast that Jesus warns us of. It is so lethal, so insidious, that Jesus was concerned it would affect his disciples. They were different from the Pharisees at this stage. They had not closed their minds to Jesus. Far from it. But they could do. A little bit of Pharisaical yeast could still affect them. And in fact, I suppose that's exactly what happened to one of them, to Judas. But that's why he warned them. Steer clear of this. And he warns us. So perhaps, in a huge crowd like this, there's going to be a whole range of views and thoughts and opinions. But I wouldn't be at all surprised if there are a number here who just, well, quite honestly, don't really get Jesus yet. Well, come to him for help. Say, Lord, I don't really get you. Please help me. What have you got to lose? Can I plead, whatever you're thinking, please don't close your mind off and just assume there's nothing in this. Because too much is at stake. We're talking about God, the creator of the universe, the rescuer of people who've rebelled against him, coming down, getting his hands dirty, being part of us, being one with us, coming to provide for us, coming to die on the cross for us, which is why we remember that at this service tonight. And to close your mind off from that is nothing short of tragic. Stubborn hearts, rebellious minds, the yeast of the Pharisees. Watch out. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, there are so much about you that we marvel at. but that also we don't understand. Your purposes are so often beyond us. And yet, who do we think we are when we assume that we can always grasp? We need you, Lord, to open our eyes, to unstop our ears, that we might see and hear. Lord, please preserve us from this yeast, and may we do all that we can to draw people to pray that prayer, seeking sight from you, for your glory's sake. Amen.